from KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Economic booms and busts are the oldest plot line in the rural West, and they're usually connected to the resources of the land. Gold, oil, uranium. The demand builds and cities fill, but at some point the bottom falls out and you're left with a deserted Main Street. In many rural communities in the West, sky-high energy prices and new technology have brought a new boom to places like North Dakota, Wyoming, eastern Utah. Oil and natural gas fields mean thousands of jobs and a new sense of prosperity, but all this energy development has also brought people who have no history or allegiance to a place. There's high crime and drugs, not to mention the damage to the air of these places and the environment that surrounds them. Today in the program, we're exploring the social and environmental effects of the West's latest boom. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In communities throughout the West, new drilling technology and high energy prices have set the stage for one of these classic economic booms. Oil and natural gas fields have brought thousands of jobs and a new sense of prosperity to rural communities in places like North Dakota, Wyoming, eastern Utah. But these places are having a hard time keeping up with the need for infrastructure, and leaders are trying to slow the pace some so they can do some planning. But when a boom comes, it seems to be incredibly impatient. All this energy development has also brought new people who have no history or allegiance to these places. Often there is high crime and drugs, not to mention the damage to the air in these places and the environment that surrounds them. Today we're exploring the social and environmental effects of the West's latest boom. We're using as our guide for the show a new documentary produced by reporter John McChesney. You probably recognize that name. John has worked in public radio for years. These days, he heads the Rural West Initiative. It's a research project at Stanford University. He and his colleagues examine the challenging issues faced by communities throughout the Rural West, including health care and water use. Their new documentary explores the effects of oil and gas exploration. We're talking about it, and we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and Twitter as well. John McChesney, as we said, the director of the Rural West Initiative. For 30 years, nearly 30 years anyway, he worked as an editor, a correspondent, and a news executive for NPR, where he established both the foreign and national news desks. We should mention you can find a link to the documentary we mentioned on our website, kuer.org/Radio West. John is joining us today from member station KRCB in Rohnert Park, California. And John McChesney, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I wanted to start, I guess, let me start this way. This is a pretty old story for the West, pretty familiar story, you think?
It is. I mean, the extractive industries have been active since the gold rush in 49 across the West. I have a feeling that this one is a little different. This new technique of horizontal drilling plus fracking, you know, the hydraulic fracturing of formations deep below the earth, sometimes 3 miles deep, is going to go on for some time. Yeah. In North Dakota, for example, on the Bakken field, they're projecting that the drilling there might go on 20 to 30 years. Okay. And not only does it go on for a long period of time because they're going to be drilling an area the size of West Virginia there, it requires re-drilling and refracking a lot of these wells. Their productivity at the very beginning is very high, and then it drops off very steeply after the second and third years. So they have to be refracked and re-drilled. Mm. And that's true in other places as well. So we may be seeing a boom here that sustains itself well beyond the kinds of booms we've seen in the past. Now, that's dependent on the global price of oil.
Sure.
And right now it's been hovering around $100 for, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
If the Chinese economy goes south or some big discoveries come online somewhere else, that could affect that and the drilling might slow.
Yeah. What are you trying to get at with the documentary and with your work in general? I mean, you're interested obviously in the environmental impacts, but there's something social and cultural here you're getting at as well.
Well, when I set out to do this, I thought, you know, fracking itself, the technology of fracking has gotten an awful lot of publicity, some of it half-baked, some of it pretty good. Yeah. I didn't want to do that. What I wanted to do was, how do these rural areas, particularly, I mean, really rural areas, very small towns spread apart, primarily agricultural in their beginning, how are they coping with what's really rapid industrialization of their areas? And the answer is not too well. In North Dakota, they're simply overwhelmed. All of the infrastructure, the roads, the schools, the healthcare systems, the law enforcement systems, local government, all of those things are just overwhelmed by the speed at which these things unfold. You mentioned in your opening that people are concerned about the pace, yeah. And that's what I heard more often than anything. Mm. Can't we slow this thing down? The gas isn't going away. The oil isn't going away. Why can't we slow this thing down?
Well, let's talk about North Dakota. This is Western North Dakota, and you talk about this Bakken that you mentioned, this vast region. John, how immense are we talking? You mentioned an area as large as West Virginia.
And that's within the boundaries of Western North Dakota. Yeah. This formation continues into Saskatchewan in Canada and also covers a lot of the eastern side of Montana, which is where it actually started. Yeah. And there's going to be a lot more activity in eastern Montana. It's a huge area. Yeah. And oddly enough, when you say the Bakken, it's not something that's on the surface. It's 3 miles below the surface.
Right.
And there's another formation called the Three Forks, which is just below it. And they drill down into this. And then through amazing technology, I have to say, they'll drill down and hit that formation. And then they turn a corner, 90-degree corner, and they snake along that formation. That formation sometimes is only 100 feet deep, and they guide that drill bit along that formation by taking samples as they go along. So they can snake out another 2 or 3 miles on a horizontal drill, and then they put explosive charges and high-pressure liquid in there and fracture that formation so that the oil flows.
Now, talk about the extent of the project. In the documentaries, industry leaders seem pretty determined to get at pretty much all of those 25,000 square miles, or as much as they possibly can, I guess.
Yeah, Lynn Helms, who is I call him the czar of oil and gas in North Dakota, he is really in charge of both regulating and promoting. It's kind of a dual role of the drilling up there. And he said to me that that North Dakota intends to drill every square mile of that formation. Now, I should say that they're trying up there to drill in a kind of orderly way. They're trying to drill on the corners of those sections of land so that they're putting horizontals diagonally into those so that they can minimize surface disruption. They'll have a 5-acre drill pad, and they'll drill 5 or 6 wells from that one drill pad going out at different diagonals into the land. And they try to line those up against a road so that the road building doesn't have to be so random. Mm. Now, that's just started, and it's a voluntary program. Yeah. So it remains to be seen whether or not the oil companies – the many oil companies that are drilling up there conform to that wish. It is a wish. It's a voluntary request, not a law.
Mm. Well, I guess this came up a lot. I remember during some parts of the Republican primary contest, Rick Santorum was constantly invoking North Dakota as the potential for private land and as a way of sort of chastising the federal government for over-regulating all of this. What is to talk about that dynamic between private and public, and where the federal government might play a role, if any, in this story?
Well, in North Dakota, they play a very small role. Yeah. There's not much drilling on public lands in North Dakota. Most of it is private land. And you have the oddity in the West of what's called split estate, which means that somebody owns the surface and somebody else owns what's underneath that surface, which often leads to conflict. You'll find a surface owner suddenly discovering that there's an oil company knocking in his door and they're going to come on that land and drill a well. Mm. And the surface owner has little recourse other than getting some money for surface disruption, the building of roads, wastewater ponds, the drill pad itself, the loss of agricultural land. But it leads to a lot of warfare out there in terms of anger between surface owners and subsurface owners. Mm. And what happens is that you've got an old ranching and farming community established in North Dakota, goes back to, you know, the Homestead Act in the late 19th century, and many of these families descend from the families who homesteaded there. And they're watching their way of life be turned upside down. You know, small towns, one county commissioner in North Dakota in Williston said, this used to be a five-minute town. Yeah. You know, I could come in here, meet all my neighbors, do my shopping, and get out of here. And he said, now it's a one-hour town. The traffic is extraordinary, and most of it is semi-trucks going back and forth to these wells, pickups, loads of pipe, loads of all of the equipment that is necessary for this drilling, and the town has been turned upside down. Mm. Now, for a lot of people, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
They're making money. They're making a lot of money, and people are flowing into North Dakota to take those jobs. But as you said at the outset, they come without allegiance to the area. They don't come to the area because they love it. They come because they love the job. And that means they're not citizens of long standing who have a real care for the land or the stewardship of the land.
Mm. I want to play a clip from the documentary. It's a conversation you had with one of the farmers there, talking about – you were sitting at his table there and he's talking about the problems just agriculturally, you know, with the dust and the impact it has on the wheat that they're trying to grow. But also it seems – set this up for us if you would. Nelson is his last name. I can't remember, John. What's his first name?
Donnie Nelson.
Donnie Nelson. And he's talking about how it's kind of created this divide between the haves and have-nots.
It's kind of made a divide between the have and the have-nots. I mean, you've always got that, but it just seems like it's polarized it and made it more. You know, some people, they don't own their minerals. They just own the surface, so they get nothing but the problems out of it.
This is the emotional component, really, that comes to play in this story and the effect it's having more broadly on the people who have invested their lives, really, in their... And they have such a history with these places.
Donnie later says that people are beginning to realize, even those who are getting wealthy from this, that they had a good way of life up there, mm-hmm. and it's being destroyed. Now, understand that Donnie Nelson is an activist.
Yeah,
he's been opposed to this drilling activity. I shouldn't say he's opposed to the drilling activity. Most of the people in this documentary understand that there will be exploitation of this resource. Mm-hmm. What they don't like is the pace at which it's occurring and the lack of planning for the impact on local governments, local infrastructure. It's just a kind of pell-mell thing that gets cut loose and everybody just reels from what's happening. And it seems to happen over and over again. Even though people visit areas, you know, that have had other booms and they try to learn from them, once these things get going, they rip along at a pace that's just unbelievable. In North Dakota, it's driven by leases that were signed 3 to 5 years ago at somewhere around $200 an acre.
Yeah.
Now, if you try to lease land up there, if an oil company tries to lease land, it's going for $2,000 an acre. Yeah. So you have to get a hole drilled in the ground or get started on drilling a hole in the ground in order to hold your lease at the original cost. Otherwise, you have to renegotiate. It'll cost you tenfold what you paid for it at the outset. So the pace of this thing is basically, according to the folks who live there, out of control. Mm. The state does not want to intervene and slow it down.
Not to mention the volatility of oil prices. That's got to give some sense of urgency to some degree to the story as well.
I think it does. I mean, the oil prices are, as I said, hovering around $100 a barrel for West Texas light crude. And there's no sign that that's going to let up in the near future. But one never knows. And so get drilling now. Get that high production at the top of the drilling so that you're getting all that money.
Let me play another bite. This is Dan Kalile. He is talking about – go ahead. Sorry.
He's a county commissioner of Williams County. Williams County is where Williston is. It's a huge county, and it's sort of the epicenter of what's going on there.
Here's a bite here. He talks about the resources that are being used up. People are having a hard time keeping pace with the resources that they need for a place like Williston.
They're consuming all of our resources. Our road system is being used up. All our water is being used up. We're short of water. All our sewage systems are being used up, are being overwhelmed. All of our leadership time as local public officials is consumed with this. And the industry is the only ones that are getting anything done.
That's interesting, John. I mean, talking about that, not just are you talking about practical resources, but also emotional resources. All of the focus is on this particular issue. And so what does that mean for, you know, other industries, other parts of the community, other parts of that story in a place like Williston?
Well, it depends upon what kind of industry you're in. If you're in an industry or a support industry for the oil drilling, if you're trucking water, if you're hauling pipe, if you're doing something like that, you're okay. If you're a retailer or a teacher or a cop, you're in trouble, or the schools are in trouble, or the law enforcement agencies are in trouble, because they'll take the police, for example. They'll import or recruit an officer, and he'll get out there, and the next thing you know, he's gone to the oil field because he can make two or three times what he's making as a law enforcement officer. So you've lost that law enforcement officer. For teachers, you know, the schools are growing rapidly. The number of students are growing rapidly. But when you recruit a teacher, they can't find any place to live that they can afford. The rents have gone through the roof there. I read a story of one old widow who was was paying something like $500 a month for her rent, and she got a notice that it was going to $2,000 a month. Well, she couldn't afford that. So the wage structure is great for the oil industry and all of the ancillary support industries that go with it. But for retail clerks, for people working in hamburger joints, for people who are working in bars, for people who are working in all other things, the wage structure can't keep pace with it. So it's a real problem it's a real problem.
John McChesney is with us. He's director of the Rural West Initiative at Stanford University. He produced a documentary about energy development in the rural West. You can find a link to that on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. You can join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the effects of the energy boom now playing out in the rural West. With new technology and sky-high energy prices, oil and gas fields in places like North Dakota, Wyoming, and eastern Utah have produced thousands of jobs and have brought people and prosperity to places once left for dead. But the development has also brought a number of other things like crime and drugs, damage to the air environment. Today we're exploring what happens to the people in a landscape when the energy boom comes to town. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. John McChesney is with us. He's the director of the Rural West Initiative at Stanford University. He's produced a documentary about this particular story. And I should mention, you can find a link to that on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. So, John McChesney, let's talk about Pinedale, Wyoming, which is the other another part of this story. What is it that interested you in this part? I guess that there were certain lessons that could be learned, because they're sort of far down the line in this, in terms of this particular story as well.
Well, the structure of the documentary is to look at a place that's in the middle of a ripping boom. That would be North Dakota. And a place that's been through one, and another place in eastern Wyoming that's just on the cusp of potential boom. Not clear it's going to happen, but everybody's anticipating it. In Pinedale, there's been a natural gas boom going on there for, you know, 10 more years than that, but basically the intensity of it is over the last 10 years. And it changed life in that small town of Pinedale and Big Piney and the areas there. But what I focused on there was the air pollution that's happened. Now, you have to understand that this is some of the most beautiful land in the country, and it's framed by two mountain ranges, the Wyoming Range to the west and the Wind River Range to the east. And Jackson is up north. It's on the upper Green River Valley, which is all part of it flows down from Yellowstone. It's a beautiful area. It had the cleanest air in the United States. It now has some of the worst. In 2010, it had 13 days of ozone alerts. That meant you're supposed to stay inside because the ozone was so high, it's harmful to your health. Other people there pointed out to me that even when the ozone spikes aren't there, all of the NOx and VOX, nitrogen oxide components and volatile organic compounds, are still there, and they're still breathing those. So people are – what I called it was – it's kind of a hangover from an energy boom. It's transformed the town of Pinedale in many beneficial ways. They have an aquatic park and physical therapy facility that – is just beyond belief for a small town of 2,500. They have a library that's gorgeous. They have schools that are phenomenal. But people still have a deep ambivalence about what happened to them there, particularly the loss of their environment. Mm-hmm. That has disturbed them a lot. It's disrupted wildlife, the migration patterns of mule deer, antelope. It's disrupting the environment for the sage grouse. So you find people there saying, yeah, it's done us some good, but golly, we've lost an awful lot.
One of the things you point out, is certainly in this part of the film, is that people are not opposed to developing these resources. As you've said, what they want is people to just sort of slow the pace all of this so they can do some thinking about it and do some planning about it. I want to play a clip from Elaine Crumpley. Introduce us to Elaine, if you would.
Elaine is a seventh grade science teacher in a school there. And actually, it was one of her students, a seventh grade student, who actually discovered the presence of ozone up on the gas field. She went to a public meeting and officials there attacked her findings, and she stood her ground, and she was right. There was high ozone levels up there. So Elaine, in some ways, was responsible for this discovery.
You know, the gas isn't going to go anywhere. It's there. It's in the ground. This could be done in a clean way without causing harm. But right now, it's all voluntary, and it's like faith-based science or something. You have to be told. You have to be held accountable.
What do people think of Elaine Crumpley there, John McChesney?
Well, it's, you know, the environmentalists there are a small crowd. As another environmentalist, Linda Baker, that we interviewed, said, it's a little hard for people to come out of their comfort zone in an area that's experiencing economic prosperity as a result of this. So why? Why come out and complain about the environmental disruption? The interesting thing here in the Pinedale area is that the energy companies have taken considerable measures to try to reduce these emissions. They have put a kind of filter or catalytic converter on their diesel engines on their drilling rigs. Those mm-hmm. things burn 3,000 gallons of diesel fuel a day. And they have reduced emissions. They've put in pipelines. They've tried to cut down on the truck traffic. And in spite of all those measures, they hit these ozone spikes. Mm-hmm. And everybody's sort of scratching their head saying, what's going on there? And one of the things that may be going on is something called fugitive emissions, that is, emissions from the drilling process itself and from leakages in pipelines and the various apparatus that all goes with, you know, transporting natural gas. No one's quite certain. But I have to say the industry is still working on it. They don't like this. Mm. It's not good for their PR image, and it's just not good. So they're working on it. Whether they'll whip it or not is still uncertain.
Yeah. You talked to some of the ranchers in the region. Joel Bausman is one of them that you talked to as well. Thinks the boom has been good for the place.
Yep, he does.
It's provided jobs to some of these young people growing up on ranches that can have a wintertime job, for example, driving a gravel truck and get paid good, $20 to $25 an hour in wages. And that's made it possible for a lot of our young people to stay engaged in agriculture.
I thought this was a compelling story because this is such a dilemma in the rural West, how it is that some of these ranchers who have been, you know, that's been in their family for generations, how they get their kids to get involved. And here's one way. You know, they can do this for a time and they can stay involved in the family business. So it's really tempting, it seems.
It's not just tempting. It's true that, you know, this is a way for people to go through those long Wyoming winters where, in terms of ranching, not a whole lot's happening and you don't have a lot of income. So those kids are able to stay. They make a pretty good living driving trucks or, you know, many other kinds of ancillary businesses that support the gas industry in that area. Joel, by the way, is a county councilman for Sublette County. Sublette County is really the area, the whole area where this drilling has been going on. And he's very pro-industry.
Yeah.
Other ranchers, you know, will tell you that. The ranchers there are very reluctant to talk about this because some of their neighbors have gotten wealthy and some of them haven't. It's that divide that you heard about in North Dakota. So there's a reluctance on the part of them to speak out. I should add that Elaine Crumpley's group called CURED, which is the Citizens United for Responsible Energy Development, sued the EPA to get Sublette County in that area declared what's called a non-attainment area. Mm-hmm. And I think about a week ago, the EPA actually declared it a non-attainment area and gave the gas companies, if I'm correct, a couple of years to correct the situation there. So they've, as I say in the documentary, one of the things that people say in places like Pinedale is the most important thing to do is to organize, to get yourself together so that you have a seat at the table. And you may not be opposed to the drilling, but you can try to put pressure on the companies to do it in an orderly and environmentally safe fashion.
In the film, you raised that question of what it is that motivated some of these people to come to Pinedale. You know, and one city leader mentions that they didn't come for the lifestyle and they didn't come for the clean air and they didn't come for the water. They came looking for a job. There's a moment here. I want to play this from local historian Ann Noble, who talks about the effects of all of this on the community and the culture. And this term gas trash comes up. John, you want to say something about that before I play this clip? Gas trash?
That becomes a common term, and you hear it in the oil fields as well. Anne, in this clip, refers to them that way. She also later said, you know, we adjusted to these folks, but this is what she said.
There wasn't an aspect of our life that wasn't changed. church life changed, schools changed radically, our traffic changed, how we were raising our children quickly had to change. Because of all these strangers suddenly in our lives, when we were a very, very small community prior to that, yes, and there wasn't a part of our life that seemed like that wasn't impacted very quickly and very intensely. And that's, of course, then we started stereotyping that young worker that has a baseball cap but insists on putting the bill on the back of his neck and has very large muscles that are all arm muscles that are always covered with lots and lots of tattoos and wearing a lot of black and chains. And, well, we just refer to them as the gas trash.
It's an interesting twist on the story, I have to say. It's another element here to think about.
You get a huge influx of young men. And up in North Dakota, they have what they call man camps, and they are man camps. Mm-hmm. They are made up largely, almost totally, not altogether totally, but almost totally, of young men who come to seek jobs. And many of them are roughnecks. They work hard in the fields. And they play hard, too. And Pinedale has 6 bars. It's a town of 2,500. Someone pointed out to me, well, we have 6 churches, too, so it's kind of an offset. But in Wyoming, people just say, when you talk about drinking, you say, well, it's Wyoming. North Dakota, you know, is experiencing huge law enforcement problems. The gun permits, concealed carry permits in western North Dakota are through the roof, and many of them, lots of them, are for women. There was a kidnapping of a teacher and murder of a teacher in Sydney, Montana, which is just across the border, which has aroused a lot of emotion about people coming. It was 2 guys who came in to get jobs in the oil field. So there is this influx of young men who are hardworking and hard living, and it sets. And they don't really have, as the mayor Stephen Smith of Pinedale says, they don't really have a particular allegiance to the area other than their job. Interestingly enough, in Wyoming, they don't pay any income taxes either, so none of that money that they're earning stays behind in the state, except for sales taxes when they buy toys. Motorboats and mobile homes and stuff. Mm.
When we come back from a break, we're going to bring the story back around to Utah, because a part of the story may be playing out in eastern Utah. John McChesney is with us, director of the Rural West Initiative at Stanford University, produced a documentary about all of this, which you can find a link to on our website, kuer.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the effects of the energy boom now playing out in the rural West. John McChesney, the director of the Rural West Initiative at Stanford University, he's with us. He's produced a documentary about this story, which you can, by the way, find a link to on our website at kuer.org/Radio West. Last week, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced the approval of a plan that will allow the Anadarko Petroleum Corporation to drill some 3,700 natural gas wells in Utah's Uinta Basin. That's in eastern Utah. The plan represents a compromise between the energy company and a conservation group, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. In exchange for the right to expand its current drilling operations in the Uinta Basin, Anadarko agreed at SUA's behest to pull its proposal to drill in new areas, including a proposed Red Rock Wilderness area. This development and others are having a profound effect on communities in eastern Utah, including the city of Vernal. Steve Block is an attorney and the Energy Program Director for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, or SUA, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Steve, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Doug.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the agreement. How did this come about? How is it possible that you were able to reach some sort of an agreement for all of this? because it's pretty remarkable in some ways.
Well, it's not the first time, but it is, I think, fairly striking that a conservation group like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, whose mission is the protection of about 9.5 million acres of the remarkable Red Rock Wilderness in the state of Utah, could sit down with this energy company, Anadarko, and reach an agreement. And what we found with Anadarko and what we found with other companies is that there is a willingness to sit down, roll up our sleeves, and work through some of these very difficult plans that these companies have to expand on the public lands.
Why is there a willingness on their part?
Well, I think they're looking for certainty. This company, like most, wants certainty for their investors, for their operations, for how are they going to proceed, as you heard from John, in an orderly fashion on the public lands. Unlike in Pinedale or in Williston, the Uinta Basin has really seen a boom-bust economy for 50, 60 or so years. And unlike those places, we're primarily federal surface and federal mineral. There's not as much of the private land or the split estate. So the Bureau of Land Management is helping to drive some of these plans, and it's generally happening now with Secretary Salazar in a more thoughtful way. And as I said, we sat down with Anadarko and worked out an agreement that's effectively a zoning decision. It says, here's an area where Anadarko has been developing on the public lands, this area called the Greater Natural Buttes Field. It's a natural gas field. That's where they're going to focus their efforts. There's an area that's proposed for wilderness that's called the White River, wilderness area. And, it's one of these remarkable gems in our state. And this company was willing to say, we acknowledge that you have concerns about it, and we're going to try and mitigate our impacts overall by reducing our footprint in this area.
You've heard John talking about the stories, as you mentioned, Pinedale and Williston. Are you seeing the similar kinds of dynamics developing in a place like Vernal?
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels, especially with Pinedale right now. The Uinta Basin had the worst air quality for wintertime ozone in 2011, and we're also very close in that area to being called a non-attainment area, so an area where the air quality, the wintertime ozone, has just gotten so bad that it calls for federal intervention. We're also seeing a real taxing, I think, of local infrastructure, if it's roads or it's schools, the same kind of stories about the impacts to human health from having this high level of development are all playing out in Vernal. And this is an area that, as I said, while it's seen this level of development in the past 50, 60 years, it's almost at unprecedented levels now.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Mary Bernard is joining us, a reporter who covers energy and crime at the Vernal Express. It's a newspaper in the area, and she's joining us today from Vernal. Mary, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
So let me describe Vernal for us, if you would. Are you seeing parallels between Vernal and some of these other stories like Pinedale, like Williston?
To a certain degree, but I think the fact that much of our development has been on public lands, primarily BLM land, and then state land, the area around Vernal, the Uinta Basin, that includes Uinta County and Duchesne County, has been the recipient of tremendous influx of mineral lease funds. And in this particular area, they've been able to maybe divert some of those impacts by developing special service districts ahead of the oil and gas boom back in 2007, 2006. And what they did was these districts manage the influx of monies for, say, recreation, health care. They built new buildings as a consequence, and that includes the educational facilities here. And so there's new colleges, new the university, Utah State University is here, new facilities, and developed new programs in relationship to the community. So We are not looking at just developing roughneck jobs, for example. We're looking to develop our homegrown engineers. And it may be focused on the energy industry, but for the most part, what we're trying to do is build a community with an educational foundation so people will be able to stay and not leave and not become the itinerant field workers that seem to be a problem in Wyoming and South Dakota or North Dakota.
John McChesney, let me bring you back into the conversation. So is this a parallel story? I mean, doesn't the fact that there's so much federal land and federal regulation that comes into play in Vernal makes it a difficult model to translate anywhere else, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't. The Pinedale Anticline and the Jonah Fields are also on BLM land.
Yeah.
And if you listen to people up there, they'll say, yes, there are environmental impact statements made. BLM is also supposed to make a socioeconomic impact study, which they rarely do. In that particular case, a lot of people are unsatisfied with what happened with BLM. I think this case that out in the Uinta Basin is really fascinating, and if it works, it'll be amazing. It'll be terrific, and it could be a model for other areas. Maybe they've learned a little bit from what happened up in Wyoming. One thing you have to keep in mind is that I think, if I read this correctly, 3,600 new wells will be drilled out there by Anadarko. And up in Jonah and Pinedale, there are another 4,000 or 5,000 wells coming online over the next 10 years. And to some extent, I think I'm right about this. You guys can correct me. Those areas share kind of an airshed, so to speak. And those emissions, that air pollution, is the problem that just hasn't been solved. And I noticed that Anadarko said it was going to look at what are called fugitive emissions and try to correct for those. But apparently nobody has really gotten a grip on that yet. What's your sense of what's going to happen out there in terms of air pollution?
Steve Block, you first.
Well, I think that, I think it's unclear. I think the Uinta Basin in the wintertime, when we get snow on the ground, causes, similar to the Salt Lake Valley, we get these inversions. And it's those inversions which are being linked qualitatively, not yet quantitatively, to the wintertime ozone. This past year we had low snowfall, so I think they didn't have the same exceptionally high levels of wintertime ozone, but still high and still enough for us to be in non-attainment if you'd average the 3 years. But I mean, John's right. You know, fugitive emissions are a large part of the problem. I know these companies are trying to use things called sniffers, which is, you know, using infrared technology to clamp down on it. They're also trying to eliminate things called evaporative ponds, which are where these NOx and VOCs are emitted. But it's a huge problem. And the Environmental Protection Agency, Region 8, is the same region for Utah, for Wyoming, for North Dakota. They're trying to get a handle on this issue, now working with the state of Utah, the federal agencies, the federal land management agencies in the counties, to have studies about this. It's a little I think from our side, we feel like there could be more done now, but what we're hearing from the federal agencies is they want to continue to study the problem to have a better causal link of the wintertime ozone.
Mary Bernard, anything to add to that?
Well, one of the I agree with everything that's been said up to this point, and one of the things that I know, for example, this year's study, it was funded in part by the industry itself as well as to the universities in order to ascertain whether or not wintertime ozone was solely the problem of the snowpack that we had in previous years. We are very concerned about VOCs and this fugitive contribution to poor air quality, and would like to be able to avoid non-attainment at all costs. I know, for example, that companies are voluntarily now, ahead of EPA regulation, containing the flowback fluids So that would be from hydraulic fracturing. Those evaporative ponds that Steve was talking about will go by the wayside. They will be obsolete. They're also trying to limit the amount of truck traffic, anything that might contribute to poor or more exacerbated air quality during the wintertime because of these inversions. And I don't know what the outcome has been. They're supposed to publish this information here soon about the study. That was a $5.5 million study that was done just this year, this past winter, by NOAA.
Steve Block, you wanted to say something?
Oh, well, I was just going to add a couple of points. One is, and I think Mary, you know, has reported on this, we've seen it in the local newspapers here in Salt Lake, is that these high ozone levels have real human health impacts. And it's something I feel like is underreported. I think we talk about ozone in the abstract, like high ozone levels are bad. Well, why are they bad? Well, they're bad for the environment, for plants, for natural systems, but they also have real significant human health impacts. And the other is, and this is maybe something for John, the local county, the state of Utah, are vigorously opposed to a non-attainment finding from from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. But that's not what I'm hearing from industry. I think industry, as I said earlier, wants certainty, and they want to know what the ground rules are for development. And so it seems like it's a way to really address the problem.
John, hold on just a moment, because we're going to lose Mary here in a moment, and I wanted to get her perspective on this Anadarko deal before we lose you. I know we only have a few more minutes with you. What do you make of the deal itself, and what are people in the community saying about it? I mean, they must feel conflicted in some way. It's a pretty conservative place, probably feel some, a good majority of them, some suspicion of environmentalists, like is typically the case in rural Utah. So what are you hearing?
It's very positive. People are very hopeful that over the decade that comes, we will be able to add these jobs and keep these people working and living here in the basin. There was some criticism, however, of how the deal was crafted. And I think a lot of that criticism was based in, we'd rather see, for example, that the environmentalists didn't have special consideration. Why should they have a better seat at the table? And what people wanted was that the regulation came through the RMPs, the resource management plans themselves. For the most part, however, everything I've heard was positive.
Mary Bernard, a reporter covering energy and crime for the Vernal Express, joined us there from Vernal. Mary, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Doug.
John McChesney, come back to you. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
That's okay. That's okay. I just thought it would be useful to put this in some perspective. The Bureau of Land Management estimates that 96,000 new wells will be drilled in the American West over the next 20 years, and that's on public land alone. That does not include private lands. This was from a study, and a study that was made by the University of Montana, the Audubon Society, and the Nature Conservancy, concludes that about 11.8 million acres of sagebrush shrub and grassland habitat will be affected over those 20 years. It's an enormous amount of land, an enormous amount of drilling just on public land. If you add in what's happening in North Dakota and eastern Wyoming on the Niobrara Formation, that's all on private land. So there's a huge amount of drilling in the future. And the federal government and local governments need to get a grip on it. And one thing that happens in some of these states is that their departments of environmental quality and their oil and gas divisions are woefully understaffed to oversee the number of wells that are being drilled. Just wanted to put that in there. One more thing before I want to plug my colleague Jeff McGee for working on me with this documentary, and he's produced what's called a player. And if you look at our documentary, footnotes appear as you go through it, and you can drill down deeper in the documentary than you could just watching the video. So it's a good thing to watch. He did a brilliant job on this.
Steve Block, do you see a political will shifting? Do you see some sense that people are wondering what the effects of all of this is going to be? I mean, what are you seeing in the next, say, 5 years or so in terms of the way people are thinking about this in those communities and elsewhere?
Well, speaking strictly for what's happening here in Utah, there's a general acceptance of this, you know, that the development is going to come and that it's good. And I think a part of our concern, speaking for the conservation movement, is that we're going to lose very special places in that rush. You know, they hope that the boom will continue, and it's our job, it's our voice to bring some balance to the discussion. And I think the agreement, like we struck with Anadarko, and as I said, we've struck with other operators, allows for some zoning, allows for the special public lands to avoid those sort of impacts. So we do have some places like Desolation Canyon and the White River for recreation, for solitude, for wildlife. But I don't see it. I don't see the pressure relenting. And I actually just came up here from a conference that's also being held at the University of Utah today about shale and sands. So that's oil shale and tar sands development as another wave that is set to break here in eastern Utah. I'm not sure how that fits in.
John McChesney, less than a minute. Do you want to say some final words here?
No, I think that I almost went to that conference. That is interesting. You know, it's the tar sands that we've seen up in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Very dirty stuff. Hard to figure out how to get it out cleanly. You know, the American West is in for it in terms of oil and gas exploitation. And really, planning is the bottom line. And I think SUA and Anadarko have done a remarkable thing here. I hope it really plays out the way people hope it does.
It's John McChesney, director of the Rural West Initiative at Stanford University. Go to our website for a link to the Rural West Initiative. And John, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Steve Block, attorney and energy program director for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.